Okay, so everybody is going to have their opportunity to say who they are and what they do, but I think it's a proper real, and we're going to have lots of readings this morning.
Yeah.
Or at least three.
At least.
Yeah. but it all began in a log cabin. No. So that's Mary Tyler Moore. it all began in a garage.
It actually began on a street corner.
As so many stories do.
Yes. You know, I was...
You are?
Oh, my name is Matt Kressel. And I am the...
I know people watching their radios are going, I know that guy.
Yeah, the publisher... I am the publisher and editor of Sybil's Garage. And so the magazine... It started off as a magazine. I was in a Altered Fluid, as Jim mentioned. And I'm still in the group. It's a writer's group. And one of our members, Chris Dykman, and actually Eugene, also Eugene Myers... would bring in zines, basically, which are, you know, kind of small press magazines, you know, usually home-produced, print on a laser printer, like Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet and Electric Philosophy, and I think back then there was Say magazine, and there was a few others. And
I did my zine on a mimeograph.
Right, yeah, so, you know. And,
I did, I'm not making that up.
Yeah, and you could tell, like, basically it was just someone would print it out in a laser printer, fold it over.
That was last year. No, sorry.
Yeah. Fold it over and staple it. So I was like, oh, this looks really fun to do. So I was batting around the idea of doing one myself, and I was trying to come up with a name. So Devin Poore and I were walking home from a writer's group meeting, and we both lived in Hoboken at the time, and I suggested Sybil's Cave, which is a landmark in Hoboken, which has a whole history behind it, and Devin said in response, it's probably a garage by now, because Hoboken's been heavily gentrified, and so that's how the name Sybil's Garage came to be. And the first issue was literally... not quite photocopied, but printed out on a laser printer. I folded it by hand, stapled it. I think I printed 40 copies and gave them out to a bunch of friends. And it was really a hit. I think everyone really liked it. And so when I decided to do the second issue, I put an ad on Craigslist because I said, you know, I'm gonna solicit stories from people in the New York area instead of just... The first issue was pretty much a vanity thing. It was just a couple people I knew sent me stories. The second issue, I said, you know, I want to solicit from other people. But I was afraid I was going to get inundated. Somehow Raylan, which is an online market report, Raylan.com, got wind of this Craigslist listing and asked... said, oh, can I put it on Raylan? And I was like, well, I don't know. You know, I'm going to get so many stories, I won't be able to keep up. So I came to my writers group and I said, do any of you want to help me read stories? And about half the members of the group said, sure. So that's
the
when...
The other half laughed.
Yeah, the other half was like, no way.
They were the smart half.
Yeah.
And that, of course, also explains a lot of the crossover between Altered Fluid and Sybil's Garage.
Right. So since then, the magazine has had... I have had a lot of help from people in the group. The readers have shifted over time. Some people are involved in projects, don't have time. You know, some people.
And when you say readers, you mean first editors.
First readers, slash readers. But I mean, they do a lot more than that, which I hope to talk about today. It's not just this first readers. They also comment on the stories. We all discuss it. We have like a private kind of content management system that we use, so that when a story comes in, if one of us likes it, another one doesn't, it allows all of us to comment on the story. So when I choose the list for the issue, everyone's commented on it. Everyone has gets their say, and I use all of those opinions when I make the story, when I choose the story. So I mean that's basically how it came to be. I mean there's a lot of other small little details, but
in which the
Matt,
devil
you should,
lives.
You should talk about how the magazine has evolved from its initial incarnation as just kind of a pamphlet to really a full-blown anthology.
Yeah, so as I said, you know, it started on on a laser printer. I was working at a print shop in Hoboken, and I printed it out in a laser printer, and I folded it over. And the second issue, I decided to use a professional printer. So I think I emailed Gavin Grant, I asked him where he printed Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet. Or either I emailed him or I looked in the back. I know they had said, we printed it at this place. And so I called up this place and started going with the professional printer.
And in those days, Lady Churchill's was like saddle-stitched, right?
Saddle-stitched, yeah, which is basically folded in half, staple right in the middle, for those people who don't know what that is. And
sounds like something very painful at a dude ranch, yeah.
Yeah. And so they, I guess issues 1 through 3 had a kind of sepia-toned cover. It was on almost like, you might call it a very thick resume paper, maybe, and the inside was just, you know, 60-pound white paper. And then with issue number 4, I decided to go with a color cover and perfect bound. And I think around the time we hit issue 3 and went to 4, I think that's when the magazine really started to get noticed by a lot of people. At cons, on blogs, all across the internet, people started to notice
it. Sort of makes a transition there, I would say, from fanzine to semi-prozine to now pro-periodical.
I wouldn't call it pro for several reasons. Mainly, the first one is, you know, we really just don't pay that much.
What are the CIFWA rates?
I think it's 5 cents
a
word.
You're not paying 5 cents
a word.
No,
we're not.
Okay.
No. And I think the semi-pro is that the producers make a part of their living. I don't know if that's... I know there's several criteria.
You see, I use a very loose radio I don't care definition, which is, wow, it looks pretty pro to me.
I think that the production and the quality of the stories is pro, but by other standards, circulation numbers, pay rates and things like that, it's not considered pro by CIFWA, you know.
Okay.
I mean, yeah.
What is the CIRC?
It's in the low hundreds. It's not enormous, but maybe your show can help change that.
One never knows.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm actually surprised because, you cannot distinguish it from, things that you find in bookstores.
Well, this issue in particular was purposely designed to look more like a trade paperback than a zine or a magazine, and that facilitated getting it into bookstores and online book retailers and things like that.
Yeah. Is there, outside of if you and your readers like it, is there an editorial thrust to Sybil's Garage? How would you describe it?
Well, I feel like I've been hogging the microphone, and there's 6 other people here, so maybe, I don't know, David, do you want to talk about that? Or?
Yeah, sure. I think that when the magazine first started, we were all looking for stories that couldn't be categorized. We've heard other people say that same sort of thing, but really we were looking for kind of artistic stories that you couldn't quite classify as science fiction or horror or fantasy, something that more slipstreamy type stories. And it initially started that way. I would say the thrust of the first few issues were along those lines. And strangely enough, we got into this pattern where we started to get dead baby stories. And it became a running joke that every time we got a dead baby story, we'd make sure to let the other editors know that.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I think it's because we had a couple stories in the first few issues that had, just by coincidence, dead babies.
Every issue we get at least one. I don't know if that's just, there are just people out there that like to write dead baby stories.
But do you remember the jokes? Are any of you old enough to remember dead baby jokes? That was a craze. How do you bowl with a dead baby? 2 fingers in the eyes, 1 in the mouth. I mean,
oh, boy.
I mean, There was a craze. There was, you know, it was a thing for a month at least.
Well, I don't think these stories are really tongue in cheek. Like,
no pun intended.
Or finger in.
Unfortunately, we were very earnest about the dead babies.
Yeah. Oh no! I mean, there were really this.
Oh, I remember.
There was a craze for a while. What was maybe 15 years ago?
Longer than that.
Yeah. Oh God. Okay.
For this current issue, Sybil's Garage number 7, we made a concerted effort to find stories that had a more traditional arc, because a lot of the previous stories were more slipstreaming. So we were looking for a little bit more traditional story this time around, although we did wind up with a nice mix in any event.
Yeah, there are some stories in this issue that are obviously science fiction, you know, whereas I think in earlier issues, David said, they sort of were cross-genre, you know, interstitial is what some people might call it, where this issue, I think, has a mix of interstitial slipstream and then more traditional type stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then also, you know, we also include poetry, which is pretty unusual for a lot of poetry, which is unusual for a lot of magazines.
Yeah.
And we always have a nonfiction piece.
I don't know, Space and Time always does some poetry.
Asimov's, you know, a couple here in Dispersed.
Right, right.
I think in this issue we have 9 poems, which is more than...
That's a lot, yeah.
Most...
Yeah, and we have a terrific nonfiction article, an analysis of the movie Inglourious Basterds by Avi Kotzer, which is phenomenal. He gives it the type of treatment that some fans of Blade Runner might give that movie.
Not that there would be any in this room.
Mm.
He said, looking at Matt.
Yeah. I have an obsession with the film.
Did you ever get that 5 DVD set, by the way?
Yes.
I won't let Matt forget that he skipped out on an altered fluid meeting so that he could go see a screening of Blade Runner that he had seen the night before.
How often can you get to see it in the theater?
At least twice, evidently.
Yeah.
Evidently. I mean, Avatar is coming back, I think yesterday.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I have little doubt that there will be Blade Runner screenings in the future as well. On big screen.
2019, and I'm in L.A. I'll be there with the
for the, yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, no doubt. Will Harrison Ford be there? Probably will be.
If he's still alive.
His head in a jar.
I would think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez. That was... So getting back to Sybil's Garage.
Yes.
Well, let's see. I mean, you had a lot of points. We're going to get to some readings from the magazine in about 15 minutes or so. Unless you want to start one early talk. I mean, you know, we can do reading, or we can reading, talk.
Well, we have 3 authors here. I was going to say tonight. This morning.
It's tonight. It's the hour of the wolf. It's in between the two. It's an interstitial moment.
Yes. E.C. Myers and Catherine Baker, who you may know as Kate Baker from her podcasting, from issue 7. And they're both in issue 7. And Barbara Krasnov, who's been in issues 4 and 5. So it's a nice, I think it's a nice mix of styles, the all 3 stories, so you can get a sample of the stuff we publish. I notice sometimes people post on their blog that they're not quite sure what we're looking for, and I think that's both good and bad. It's good because I like to surprise people, but it's bad because I think people, you know, they kind of want to know what to expect when they buy the issue, but I hope that there's enough good, strong variety of stories in it that you pick it up, and there's, you know, several that you will like. And so hopefully these stories are all great, otherwise I wouldn't have published them. But hope the listeners feel the same way.
Okay. So where to from here? Do we want a reading? Do we want
Eugene? Did you want to go ahead and
sure,
read a section?
Okay, if you're going to do that, I'd like you to pull your mic closer to yourself.
Okay, or I can move closer to the mic.
Yeah, well, both. Yes. Change the proximity. And first of all, so as each person reads, also I'll want you to introduce yourself more fully.
Sure. So my name is Eugene Myers, but I publish as E.C. Myers, and there's a long story behind why I chose to use a pseudonym. I'm glad you asked, Evan. There's a guy out there, maybe he's listening, but probably not, whose name is also Eugene Myers, who when I started to write and hopefully publish, I Googled myself in conjunction with the word science fiction to see if there were any other science fiction writers out there with my name. And there was this guy who's apparently blogging something that he calls the American Book of the Dead, which he claims to be the future history of America. And
I've actually encountered that.
Yeah, I've looked at it a little bit, and it's kind of interesting. So I wanted to kind of distance myself from that, and I actually have never really liked the name Eugene growing up. Funny thing, that. And so I just decided to go with EC, and now it's stuck. So.
And it sounds like a comic book.
Yeah. Series. Yeah, actually, one day I'm going to redesign my website to
look like
mimic
EC.
The EC comics.
Yeah.
You know, okay. As long as I can avoid a lawsuit. So, and as people have mentioned, I'm part of the writing group Altered Fluid. I'm an occasional editor for Sybil's Garage, which would normally present a kind of a conflict, but for this last issue 7, I was one of the people who was working on a project and unable to help read some of the slush. So I took the opportunity to submit a story this time around.
I mean, it probably goes without saying, but, you know, before people jump to the conclusion that I published his story because he's in the writer's group, it didn't happen that way. He submitted the story just like everybody else, and it went through the submission queue, and we all reviewed it and talked about it and decided, you know, so it, like, you know, we published the story because it's a really good story, not because he's a friend of mine, you know. And I that goes without saying, but I just thought I should say it.
and it also has to be mentioned that even in the pro levels, you know, the genre communities, using the plural there, they are, of course they're going to be inbred. There's what? You know, at WorldCon, there's 5,000 people attending. That's the so-called WorldCon. It's really AmericaCon, even though it's in Australia. But that's sort of what it comes down to. So there has to be crossovers between personal lives and stuff like that. Where I think it gets scary, of course, is when somebody's a critic. One thing, when the editor and all that, I've always wondered about the people who are critics.
They don't have very many friends. cons. They're the one in the corner.
Well, yeah, you never know. Although, you know, nobody doesn't like Rose Fox, you know, although she's with Publishers Weekly.
Well, Publishers Weekly does anonymous reviews, though.
They do anonymous reviews, but you still sort of know if it's a science fiction review, it has passed her desk.
I don't think she writes them, though.
No, I don't know that she writes them, but that she's the editor of them.
Mm. Well, I'm sure Rose is listening right now. So
yeah,
she
we
can
love
always,
you, Rose.
She can always call in as
director. And by the way, she's curating the October New York Review of Science Fiction reading, which is way cool.
Very cool.
Yeah, so I thought
my story in this issue, I'm really happy to have this published in Sybil's Garage. My story is called My Father's Eyes, and I'm going to start sort of in the middle. But to back up a little bit, it's about a kid, a college kid named Ambrose, who is a photographer, and he is out at what is known as a reservation for regressives, which are people who have contracted a very rare disease called Hollander's disease, which is a sort of a form of dementia that causes them to regress to a very primitive state of mind. And on this class assignment, basically, he discovers that his father is living there, the father who left when he was very young. And so he's very surprised and a little bit angry at his mother for withholding that information from him. So this is about halfway through the story. Hollander's disease has a very slow onset, resembling Alzheimer's disease at first, then progressing very rapidly. Early symptoms include short-term memory loss, irritability, and mood swings. Long-term memory gaps and personality shifts develop, followed by disorientation and confusion. Eventually, the higher faculties deteriorate, most notably reasoning and communication. There's an accompanying loss of inhibition and an increased sex drive, a strengthening of what are considered primal urges. In the final stages, victims are reduced to simple speech and behavior. Basically, they become evolutionary throwbacks, cavemen. As I stand in complete darkness, blindly guiding the film from the cartridges onto spiral holders, I think about what my father must have gone through. When I stand in the dark room, his dark room, I always feel close to him, closer now that I know I might suffer the same fate. He knew what was happening to him, but did he lie to himself that it was all just a phase, that he would be all right, the way my mother did? When he could no longer believe his own lies, how did he keep himself going, taking pictures and making plans for his future instead of giving in to despair? I hope his photographs will give me some of the answers. There are 11 rolls of film in total, but only 8 of them yield what could be called pictures. The rest are a waste, not because of the age of the film, but because they reveal only blurry photos of nothing in particular. Impressions of grass, a cloudless sky, a full reel that looked like it was taken with a lens cap on. These are the photos of a man who is losing his mind. I make contact sheets from the negatives and examine the miniature images, organizing them in my best estimate of chronological order based on the deterioration in quality of composition and technique. I select the best of them and develop my dad's photographs one by one, growing more despondent with each new photo I pin to the line to dry. I had imagined that I could put together a collection of his work, but the pictures are almost too painful to look at. The first roll is closest to my father at the height of his talent, pictures of the neighborhood, places he had been. Some of them were long drives away, back in his hometown, 2 states away. It was like he was revisiting his life, one last time. There were also pictures of people, a lot of children in the playground, a few more pictures of me. My father was an urban photographer, documenting the city and the people that lived there. But I noticed a trend towards emptiness, a long, abandoned parking lot, an overgrown field behind a chain-linked fence, and then pictures of the open country just outside the city limits. Later, rolls seem almost random, little better than the careless snapshots of a tourist. An entire roll follows a woman walking down the streets who becomes overtly frightened of the photographer stalking her. Another shows a series of pictures of sidewalks, garbage bags, abandoned cars, piles of dog crap on the street. The rest are simply confused. Pictures of his hand, his feet, a leg, his penis, his back reflected in a mirror. Maybe he was cataloging the parts of himself, trying to stop himself from changing in the only way he knew how. By preserving himself in a photograph. There is one startling shot of his eyes, as though he had held the camera the wrong way around and peered into the lens. When I finish, exhausted from spending the whole day developing and nauseous from the chemical fumes, I leave the pictures hanging in the dark room. My mother will find them there, though I'm not sure if she should see them or not. I finally know exactly what she meant when she said my father was gone.
And you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, a slew of people this morning. We're doing 2 slew shows in a month's period. This is the first of 2. Various people from Sybil's Garage magazine, edited by Matt Kressel, and some of the other people in this room. But Eugene Myers just read that story. And after that, the song Camera by Wilco is found when you find a story, when you look up a story in Sybil's Garage, there's always a song listed.
Yeah, underneath each story or poem in every issue since the first, I've asked the author or poet to suggest a musical accompaniment to the story. I'm trying to remember the original impetus for why I
asked.
Which
is actually what I was insinuating.
And
yes.
The thing that sort of resonates, I think, is me just wanting to peer into what other people were listening to, and I mean, music has always been very inspiring for me, mm-hmm. Creatively, and I, it's always interesting for me to find what inspires other people, and you know, we're Senses 5 Press, right? So that's one of the senses, your audio.
SENSES.
Yes, SENSESFIVE. Dot com.
As opposed to people who think that we do census every 5 years instead of every 10 years.
Yeah. So, yeah, and it became this really fun and interesting way to peer into other people's music collections. And for the last issue 6, I actually made an iTunes playlist that you can find on the website. And I haven't done it yet for this issue, but I will.
You should make it a PLS, so it's not platform specific.
Well,
PLS work on iTunes?
Well, yeah.
Or an M3U or
something.
But
the thing is, I would have to distribute the MP3s as well, which I couldn't do legally, right? With the PLS?
I don't think so, no.
I don't know how that works, but I mean, with iTunes.
Well, we'll talk about it later.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. I mean, so yeah, there's quite a lot of interesting music suggested throughout, a lot of stuff that I haven't heard of, I just find that fun.
Yeah. So is it that it's intended to be sort of a soundtrack for the story, or is it the inspiration for the writer? Is that an individual choice?
I ask the writer a song or album that either influenced the story or you think would go well with the story.
Okay, you know, so it is like a soundtrack, as it were.
Yeah, yeah, I think
an accompanying soundtrack.
And I think, you know, Eugene picked a really good one, Camera by Wilco, which was pretty...
I listened to a lot of Camera songs trying to pick this out. Actually, it was really interesting for me as on the writer side of things instead of the editorial side, because I always thought that you picked the songs, Matt, for each issue, and that you were picking something that was, thematic with the story. So when I got the email asking for my suggestion, I was surprised, but pleased. And then, and this is one of those stories where I didn't have any song as an inspiration for it. There are other stories and novels that very much do have that link, but in this particular instance, I listened to a lot of songs that were about cameras before I found one that I felt really fit the story.
Now, I'm just curious. We'll talk off air about how many different camera songs there are out there, because I'm as a radio person, I'm always thinking of the segue. Whenever I have somebody reading a story in here, which I hope is pretty much every week. While they're reading, I'm thinking, what am I going to follow this with? What song shall it be? And that's, so I'm always trying to match a story to a song, and I think it's a lot of fun. And every so often I have a certain amount of success doing that on the air, and it's a wonderful thing to do that in print, as it were.
Yeah. I agree. you said it more eloquently than I could.
Wow. All right, then.
Yeah. I just also wanted to say, if it wasn't clear, that, there are multiple people helping produce the issue. You know, so in this particular issue, we had, 7 readers. Including myself, so all the stories come in, and we each get an even split of the stories. So we all read the same number of stories, and if an editor likes the story, they basically flag it, and then it comes to me for further review, and then I comment on it, and then we can all comment on it. So there's myself, Paul Berger. I'm gonna cheat just so I don't forget anybody, because it's early. Paul Berger,
late.
Who is here tonight,
Hello.
this morning. Yes, sorry. Raj and Khanna, who is he in Australia yet?
Yes.
Yeah.
WorldCon? Okay.
Yeah,
he's on his way.
He's probably over some big ocean right now. Aliyah Dawn Johnson, who's also in Australia. Devin Poor, who's here today. Mercurio Di Rivera. And
both of him are here today.
And Greer Wood
and Evil David and all three of you,
yeah. All of us. We're all
yes. And Greer Wood Woodward. Greer lives in Hawaii. And what's interesting about the we take electronic submissions, so what's great about that is that Greer can read Slush in Hawaii, you know, and offer her comments and be a part of this just the same as everybody else, which is really cool. We actually did a critique of one of her stories over Skype recently, which was kind of fun. But that's a whole nother.
But that's the other we. That's the ultra
that's
fluid.
That's the other ultra fluid, yes.
Yes.
You know, that may be why there's such a mix of stories, because there's so many different sensibilities that are involved. And we debate so many of the submissions before we make our picks that we wind up with a real nice mix of horror, fantasy, science fiction. So I think that's part of it.
You know, while Eugene was reading his story, I think there is a theme, and I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily conscious, but I definitely pick stories that have a kind of nostalgic feel to them, or longing, or loss. I notice that I pick a lot. In our previous issue, we published a story by Kay Tempest Bradford called Alain Vital, which had a very similar theme to Eugene's story.
She, by the way, will be reading a story here in 3 weeks.
Okay.
That's what I'd mention.
But yeah, I think that in terms of, you know, a nostalgic feel, definitely we tend to publish those more than others. But as David said, because we have a variety of editors, the stories we publish definitely have that mix.
Well, and I've also noticed, at least in one issue, visually there was a very nostalgic feel to that whole issue.
I would
Victorian
hold it up for
drawings.
The radio listeners to see. But
it's like here.
Why don't you hear? There you go.
It's like a flip book, you know.
Well, for a while, I was using a lot of clip art from like engravings and etchings. I had a lot of like 19th century, early 20th century clip art that you buy these books, these Dover books.
Yes, exact Dover. And
weren't you
using
images from a Sears and Roebuck catalog at one point?
Yeah, I think it was issue 2 or 3. There was a lot of images from a Sears Roebuck catalog.
Which would be about from the year 2 or 3.
Yeah. the difficulty was I would try to find an image to match the story and both, you know, have a relevant theme to the story but not spoil the story. And then after a while, I discovered that I've used all the best images from these Dover catalogs and other clip art books that I had. And at that point, I said, okay, you know, I think it's time to move on from this. And that's when I started using stock photography and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's as much as one can do without hiring illustrators.
Right.
Which is a whole other income level at that point. I take a financial level of producing the magazine.
I have a question. Matt, if I wanted to buy a copy of Sybil's Garage, how could I do that?
Well, David, it's really very easy. There are two ways. The easiest is probably just go to Amazon.com and type in Sybil's Garage.
Which is spelled?
S-Y-B-I-L, apostrophe S, Garage, G-A-R-A-G-E. You can buy it there.
Let's not mention prices, by the way, for legal reasons.
Okay. And you,
it's not expensive, we can tell people.
Or you could buy it on the Census 5 Press website, which is at censesfive.com, censesfive.com. Or you can just Google Sybil's Garage, and it's the first page that comes up. Thank you for asking.
Are back issues available?
Yes, actually, we just sold out of issue number 6. The print version is sold out. I have like 5 copies left, and I'm just going to keep those
for
my
eBay.
Own.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So that's pretty good that we sold out in about a year. The print run. This issue number 7, is actually a print-on-demand title. It's the first time I did that.
Oh.
So we can't sell out. It'll be forever in print, which is kind of cool.
You have e-books, right?
That's right. If you go to Amazon, you can buy it for the Kindle. And if you go to the website, you can buy the EPUB version.
Uh-huh.
And it's actually in the iBookstore, I've been told. I uploaded it. I don't have an iPad myself to check, but I've been told by others that it's in the iBookstore. So, yeah.
Way cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, so various media. And now, parts of it on radio.
On the radio, that's right, yeah.
And therefore also available, at least for a couple of weeks, on the Internet.
And also on the website, we have three or four pieces available for sampling. As David mentioned before, Avi Kotzer's essay on Inglourious Basterds is there. The unabridged version is on the web. It's very detailed and very interesting. We have Eric Schaller's How the Future Got Better. We have Amal El-Motar's Scheherazade, which is a beautiful poem. And what is the other one that we have online? Someone help me out here.
Is it Swapna story?
Oh, yeah. Swapna Kishore's The Unbeing of Once Leela, which is a wonderful riff on dementia. I mean, if you can say such a thing, right? it's just an exploration of dementia as it viewed through someone looking at it through almost like a Hindu cosmology in a sense.
I'm just realizing, isn't dementia also something that is an occasionally recurring theme within some Sybil's Garage stories? Certainly.
Well,
the one
Eugene's
that Eugene
story,
just
yeah.
It's funny how that works out sometimes. That
yeah.
You get the same themes.
It might have just been in this particular issue. I can't recall any from previous issues.
Well, in this issue, we have two stories that are you could argue are zombie stories, although one of them is sort of literary. You might say it's not really a zombie story, but it's funny how that happens. I know for this issue, we had quite a few number of zombie stories involving unreliable narrators. We had really some fantastic zombie-related stories, but they all had unreliable narrators. They were very similar. So we picked what we thought were the best of the bunch. So it was very interesting how that happens sometimes.
Okay. But no tropes in mind, though.
No tropes in mind, no. Should we do the next story?
Yeah.
That's what I was
going
to suggest.
Yeah, so Barbara, did you want to...
Sure.
Go ahead.
Why don't you pull the mic?
So
how's that?
Yeah. Say how's that again, and I can tell you because I just turned your mic down.
How's that?
Better. Angle it down, can you? I'm turning it off again so that you can... Well, of course not. It's WBAI. I can't get close mic to
you.
Okay, that looks good, so I'm going to assume it sounds good.
My name is Barbara Krasnov, and I am not a member of this writer's group. I'm actually a member of one called Tabula Rasa, and I've been writing for a while, and I do short stories predominantly, and I was very happy to be in Sybil's Garage 4 and 5. It's a fabulous literary journal, and in all senses of that word. I'm going to read a story from number 5, which is very short, which is why I'm reading it, and it's called All His Worldly Goods. And here goes. The ad reads, female wanted, under 30, thin, blonde, benefits, vacation, own room. I'm 32 with mousy brown hair, but I haven't seen my real color since I was 15, and I can pass for 20 if I need to. So even though the ad says nothing about the guy, assuming it is a guy, who could be a 75-year-old axe murderer for all I know, I pulse over a carefully worded note with my sample vid. The auto response looks reasonably sane, so I set an alarm and go back to work. Work means finding trends, the kind of stats that the search engine algorithms may not pick up. Doesn't bring in much, but it's worth a few groceries. Nothing new today, though. Job rate up, vice rate down, wedding rate booming, Marriage is a wonderful institution, says the Reverend President John Sprite, beaming at the vidcam. Same old, same old. I start to grab a few feeds anyway. If I can't find a real trend, I can always make one up. When my alarm sings at me. My bait is bit. The guy sends a long response in words of 6 syllables. Some kind of college guy? Along with a request for a 2-week commitment, which is totally not acceptable. I check his stats. Lives alone, good neighborhood, stable job, full benefits, not bad. I pulse back a 3-month alternative, along with a couple of paragraphs of my best post-grad banter to soothe his superego. 10 minutes later, I get back 3 screens of pseudo-Mensa crap and an agreement on 2 months with a GPS code for a person-to-person at the Hillside Real Mall, about an hour away. We're in business. My mirror tells me I've got a couple of sores coming on that could be a problem if they get any worse. I've only got 1 antiviral patch left for my stock, and if this doesn't work, I won't be able to get more. But I have to look good, and that means look healthy, so I slap it on. Some makeup to hide them until the medication kicks in, pull on a blue tube dress, and I'm ready. Grab my purse and out the door. It's a theme cafe. Ye old London with waiters in top hats and kid actors screaming for more. I pull out my phone, hit the GPS code, and locate my intended, way and back, out of direct lighting. My turn to get the hips moving, head up, smile pasted on, ready for my close-up. He's a Santa, belly that could comfortably hold 3 in vitros. Stained tea, beard that tries to make up for the weight and fails miserably. Not a total fool, obviously, since he knew enough to bargain, but when I get close, he gets a look on him like a 3-year-old at a candy con. I slide into my seat, giving him a nice glimpse of thigh, and try to look really impressed. Hey, I say, throatily, like an old movie vamp, because I will bet you any amount that this joker knows his cine. Hi, he says. He's already hyperventilating. He obviously wants smart, though, so I take it slow. I really hate this part, I say in my best Park Avenue. You have to get past the business and the awkwardness of the whole situation. I know, he tells me. It's hard to get to know somebody when things are so crass, I suggest. He likes the word. We order drinks, and I play with the straw a bit before leaning forward, making sure that just a bit of the tube slips. Let me be frank, I tell him. You know why I'm here. This isn't love at first sight. But neither will I associate myself with somebody I don't respect. I'm not that sort of person, and from your email, I don't think you are as well. As if a feeb like him would turn down this mama's birthday gift. I smile at him. We can be good for each other. Can teach each other things. He swallows and zaps the check without even looking at the total. I've got him. We stare soulfully at each other for another minute or two, and then split for the Justice of Peace storefront 2 levels down. To have and to hold in sickness and in health. For 2 months, anyway. Anything to keep the virus at bay. 1 patch at a time. With my new hubby's bennies, and my contacts, I should be able to squeeze at least 6 months of medication out of the farms over the next 60 days. And after that, if I keep my cool, the Phoebe may want an extension. Or maybe he's got friends who are looking for a 2-month wifey. Devotion guaranteed. After all, a girl's got to live.
And that was All His Worldly Goods, read for you by Barbara Krasnoff from issue number...
Five
of Sybil's Garage. You didn't say what you do when you're not writing fiction.
Oh, when I'm not writing fiction, I am the reviews editor for Computer World magazine.
Okay, so, and again, that was Barbara Krasnoff. That's a nasty little story. I like it. It reminds me just a little bit of a John Varley story, Air Raid, which is also made into the movie Millennium, God help us all, which could have been a good movie, but wasn't.
It was not.
Yeah. but she, in the story, she is falling apart.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah, that's right.
Although she doesn't seduce anyone, she kidnaps a whole bunch of people, though.
That's right. In the movie, she sort of seduces Kris Kristofferson, but that's a whole other thing. And who was she in the movie? Was it Cheryl Ladd?
No.
It was somebody like that.
It was a Charlie's Angel. It was one of those three.
Yeah. It might have been Cheryl Ladd.
I think it might have been Cheryl Ladd, actually, and she wasn't bad. It wasn't the performances that made that.
I know for sure it's the Charlie's Angel, the one with all the hair.
That doesn't differentiate.
Exactly. They all have all the hair. Well, it wasn't Farrah Fawcett.
Yes, it was, I believe, wasn't it?
I don't think so.
Hmm. I think it was Cheryl Ladd.
It was Cheryl Ladd. Oh,
yes. Yeah, yeah. Kris Kristofferson, I know.
Oh, okay.
And
I remember the story was also a novel. I read it in a novel.
He did a fix-up. I think the short story is far better than the novel. Oh. But anyhow, we are gathered here on Hour of the Wolf this morning discussing Sybil's Garage. We have some of the editors and some of the writers who are represented in this, I think, periodical,
That works.
Matt Kressel is one of the prime movers and printers and shakers of the magazine. And other people who haven't we really introduced here? Well, Kate's going to read, so she's going to get her chance. But really, Paul, Devin, and David, you should really tell, because you're not reading this morning. You should tell us a little more about yourselves.
Okay, sure. I am David Mercure Rivera, and I write a lot of science fiction stories. I've been published pretty regularly in Innerzone, which is a terrific British magazine with really high-quality stories that is worth taking a look at. A story that I published there in 2006 called Longing for Langolana won their readers' poll for favorite story of the year by the readers, and it's a world involving aliens who they're love-struck aliens who love humanity, and when they see human beings, they immediately fall head over heels in love with them, and I like playing with that dynamic of, and the humans, by the way, feel an aversion towards these aliens who supply them with this technology that they can use. So I've written another story in that same universe called In the Harsh Glow of Its Incandescent Beauty, which appeared in the March issue of InnerZone this year, and I'm writing more stories in that universe. My hope is to put together a collection of stories involving my aliens, the Worgens, who love humanity. I've had stories in Electro Velocipede, Nature, Unplugged, The Year's Best, The Web's Best, science fiction published by Rich Horton, and I've been in Altered Fluid, the writing group, since 2003 or so, and I've been an editor on Sybil's Garage magazine since issue 2 or 3, I forget when. And it's just a great experience. I love reading the slush. Even when it's bad, I like going through it, to be honest.
So, sometimes, especially when it's
bad. When you get a great story, there's nothing like that feeling when you say, oh, my gosh. And I think Devin can actually, if he's going to go next, he can talk about what it was like when he ran across Kate's story in the slush.
Oh, yeah. My name's Devin Poore, and I've been with Sybil's, I guess, since the beginning. I had a fiction piece in the first issue, and what, had 3 or 4 nonfiction pieces since then? Interviews?
Yeah,
and
several interviews, and
the genesis of Sybil's Garage.
That's right, yeah.
Piece that I did. And I write short stories and novels and things like that as well. And I'm really, really tired because I'm going on 2 hours of sleep because I was at a concert last night, so I'm not entirely coherent. But what David was saying was like about reading the slush.
I don't know what my excuse is. That's a good one for
you. Anybody in New York that's into science fiction should go see. I went and saw The Lisps last night, which is a really hard name to say, but it's a really good group. They've got a kind of like a steampunk sci-fi Civil War musical that they do. This is just really phenomenal.
And that's at Joe's Pub?
They were at Joe's Pub last night. I saw them at the Here Theater back in April where they did the full play with the costumes and everything. And they're, you know, working on getting other stagings of it, but it was really good. So definitely go check that out. But back to the reading the slush, like David was saying, sometimes even when it's bad, you know, I think as a writer, you can, if you get a story that really doesn't work, you can say, wow, I'm just never, ever going to do that whenever I write. but then, you know, also, as he was saying, sometimes there are just stories that, that really, really click with you. Like when Kate's story came through the slush this last time, I was the first person that pulled it out, and it just blew me away the first time I read it. And like Matt was saying, normally whenever we send it up, we put in like the pros and the cons, try to defend it and say, why do we like this story? And I think I just wrote by this story was like the only thing that I wrote. And the funny thing is whenever I first read it, I really didn't pick up on the speculative content. I just read it as a literary story the first time through. And I think maybe I more so than others in the editors, I really like stories like that with even without speculative content, because Sybil's is one of the magazines that will really publish anything as long as it's good. You know, it doesn't have to be science fiction or horror or fantasy. It can be, you know, poetry or just straight up literary or anything like that, which I really like.
Yeah, I do that with this show as well. It's just a very big lasso, and if it fits, it fits.
Yeah,
and that's all it is. And for I like the old definition of science fiction, or that was attributed to Damon Knight, which is science fiction is what I'm pointing at.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was one of the best ones. I don't care if it's, well, it's not science fiction, it's fantasy, it's this, it's that. And even if it doesn't have the fantastic elements that one would put in, I don't care. I remember having somebody on the program who, in fact, had read a story at KGB before Matt was involved. And it was a wonderful, wonderful story. And when all was said and done, everybody looked at each other and said, that was not science fiction in it at all, was it? And it's like, yeah, that's right. So, and, you know, because we all love it, you know, why does it matter?
I mean, I feel the same way. One of the members of Altered Fluid sent a story to a market that is well known, and the publisher rejected the story on the grounds that, I love this story, it's great, but there's nothing speculative about it. And I decided I never ever want to do that to an author. If I love the story, I'm going to print it. And,
yeah.
You know, we've been going with that. I mean,
and we're dealing with a literature that comes out of, you know, came out of a ghetto. You know, really, when this program began in 1972, science fiction was really in one of its many disreputable phases. And to say that something was science fiction was, you know, a terrible and wonderful thing. So the science fiction publishers were very, very proud in those days.
Mm.
And they would say, well, if it doesn't have that element, then you're not one of us. And I think a little of that has carried on.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a stigma on so-called genre. I mean, Hal Duncan has a great argument that there is not really... Like, everything is genre, basically. You know, it's just different things that you like. I think there's a stigma on science fiction and fantasy among readers of so-called mainstream literary fiction. Maybe not the best term, but that, you know, science fiction is somehow, you know, substandard. And I think that that is completely wrong. And I hope that... you know, with Sybil's Garage, it sort of straddles that both worlds in some sense, that people can look at this and come at it from different points of view and still appreciate it and see that, you know, they're really mining the same territory as I think Alice Turner said when she founded KGB. that's what she intended to do, to bring literary types and so-called genre types together. And, you know, I don't know, I think it's become more science fiction and fantastical, the KGB series. But anyway, I digress. But
yeah.
Paul, so, yeah.
Tell us a little Hello. About yourself.
My name is Paul Berger. I write fantasy and science fiction, mainly short work. I'm one of the original founding members of the Altered Fluid.
Do me a favor, tap your microphone.
Can you hear this?
Yeah. Oh, you know what? That I think that made it work, but yes.
So I should have just smacked it to begin with.
Yeah.
All right, well, now I've got two mics.
Much better.
So now you I'm in stereo, I guess.
One is virtually dead, yeah.
So I'm Paul Berger. I'm one of the original founding members of Altered Fluid. I've been with the group since 2001 when we first, the first original members took a class with Terry Bisson, and when that ended, we decided to keep meeting in the same short story workshop format. I have been an associate editor for Sybils probably since issue 3 or 4 now. I've got a love-hate relationship with reading slush. every time I open a new story that comes through the submission system, there's always that moment of great hope, like, this could be it, this could be the one. And sometimes it is, not always. Sometimes it's just something that's a little bit hard to slog through. But finding something, a story that really moves you, something that you want to include in the magazine, is just really rewarding. And like I said, it's a mixed bag, but overall I really love doing it. And maybe it's been a while since it's been a couple of months since we read for this issue, but I'm already looking forward to reading for the next one, which must mean that the painful aspect of going through the slush has worn off. My own work, I've been published in Strange Horizons and Fantasy Magazine recently, and Vector Magazine, which is the journal of the British Science Fiction Association, is doing a short story club where every week they're going to be critiquing and discussing another recently published short story throughout the fall. And it was just announced that they're going to discuss my recent publication, Stereogram of the Grey Fort in the Days of Her Glory, which was on a fantasy magazine a few months ago. And they'll be discussing that in November.
Okay, Rich Horton absolutely loves that story, and it's getting an awful lot of buzz this year, so good luck with that, Paul.
Which I am incredibly flattered and surprised by, but I'm very gratified.
Way cool.
Thank you very much.
Excellent. So, Kate.
Oh, my turn.
Yeah, I think it is. And let's see, is your mic working?
Testing.
Not really. Not really. Yeah, Eugene, if you wouldn't.
Hello.
Better.
You want me to speak louder? Is that better?
I think pull the mic closer as well. Well, you're an audience. Well, as we're trying to get you on mic, why don't you tell us a little about yourself? You're more of a professional reader.
Well, yeah, I've been podcasting for about 6 years now, and I started over at Starship Sofa for Tony C. Smith, and then I graduated to Clark's World magazine, where I'm now the podcast director for that.
Another great small press.
Yes, I'm enjoying
magazine,
that job tremendously.
Neil Clark, Neil, you ever going to come on the show? Anyway.
Yes. I'll have to drag him by his heels. Right.
That's right.
Yep. And we're up for a Hugo as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we just, speaking of podcasting, we got nominated for a Parsec Award as well, mm-hmm. which is excellence in science fiction. Or speculative fiction podcasting. So that was for the story The Things by Peter Watts, which I have to say was one of my favorite stories ever to read and listen to when I got to hear him up at WorldCon in Montreal. So it's been one heck of a ride as far as podcasting is concerned. And then, you know, reading all those wonderful stories, I decided to try my hand at it and start writing them. So I do not have a writing group. Hint. I'm a writing group of one, but I guess I'll start reading. I can probably read the full story, right?
Yeah.
It's short enough. All right. This story is entitled By Some Illusion. This is red. This is blue. This is orange. This is green. I could only imagine that this is what being on a rolling sea would feel like. I want to vomit. I want to scream. I want to reach out and touch the vivid blues and greens, oranges and reds. Everything had shape in my world, and now it seems my world has changed forever. I long to touch what Jane names a sweater and wrap it around my shaking body, if not just for the warmth of its embrace, but to regain the sense of limitation. I want to be squeezed and secure again. This is too much. Touch has become a poison now as I run my fingers along something she calls grass and qualifies it with yet another color. I know grass. I know the prickly yet soft feeling upon my bare feet. Her words don't match my own. The only way to define what I feel involves using concepts such as kaleidoscopic and confusion. Ultimately, these are the states of mind that I'm beginning to marry. My stomach churns again as I look up. I begin to drown in whispered white clouds and blue sky. I manage to point a shaking finger at a blob that quickly takes shape as a bird, a seagull to be exact. I sway. Jane steadies me. Despite her efforts, I lose my colorful and textured lunch all over the front of my yellow sundress. I remember the smell. I vomit again. Jane is careful as she undresses me and walks me into the shower. She pours a thick liquid in her hands, which smells like pomegranates. Pink, she offers. Your hands, what are they? I ask for the first time, remembering Jane is just not words. Flesh. Peach, white, she responds as she calmly starts to wash my body. My body! Curves of my breast, my hip, my legs, and my feet. I point excitedly to my toenails, which do not match the rest of my skin. Purple, don't you remember I painted them yesterday? Jane says with a smile upon her lips. Pink lips. I lean forward and brush my own against hers. She closes her blue eyes, and for a moment I am tempted to ask her to open them again. She slips a hand around my waist and pulls me close. Water slides from her neck, off the arteries which throb with each heartbeat. Her breath quickens with each tender touch as I trace my lips down her chest. Now she is the one to sway as I find myself upon my knees. She is so beautiful. Black dresses, black high-heeled shoes, black jackets, black tie. Burgundy, Jane whispers, as she anticipates my next question. The curtain is drawn to each side of the grand stage where musicians are tuning their instruments. The conductor bows and taps his wand upon the music stand. Each instrument is lifted to ready lips and hands. Somewhere Over the Rainbow begins to play as a larger-than-life woman appears upon a large screen behind the orchestra. I immediately grab Jane's hand. Dorothy Gale? I whisper, and Jane nods. Black and white? Just wait. I grasp onto Jane's hand as the tornado lifts the house and then quickly drops it. I follow Dorothy as she opens the now brown door. Subtle changes suddenly overwhelm as she opens it. Jane is watching me instead of the movie. She hands me a Kleenex. I suddenly realize that I need it. Jane sleeps heavily. Her eyelids flutter rapidly as she twitches and reaches out to pull me closer. Her chest rises and falls under the overly large shirt, which has ridden up over her hip. She has kicked the covers off again. I trace my finger over the smooth curve, an action I had done so many times before, yet this time it is new and exciting. I shiver at their new remembrances, with eyes closed. Jane automatically reacts to my tremble by pulling the comforter up around us both. I was used to this suffocation. It was in these hours of the night where breath and white noise became companions. Now trees weave their shadows upon the walls and red digits change upon the nightstand. It is no wonder that I cannot sleep. Even when I lose the battle, the dreams are more frightening than the unsteady streams of consciousness. There are colors in these nightmares that I still haven't named. The grandfather clock strikes five, and I turn my attention to the open window. The ghosts are finally retreating as darkness starts to lighten. I fold my hands in my lap as I sit upon the examining table. The white paper crackles as I shift. The fluorescents are unpleasant. The clock's second hand ticks at a steady interval. I am still not familiar with the numbers. I can grasp the concept, but it is only through practice that I get to places on time. I wish Jane were here instead of at work. These new routines are hard to get used to. She was so proud when I asked her to throw out all of my auricular crutches. I only realized that after I had asked her to return to her job that she was one of them. There are moments like this one that I want to scream. I want to pitch that tantrum over and over when frustration and stress become too much. I need my words, my past experiences, my old, intimate, and fading world. The door opens and in walks Dr. McCord, dark skin, dark hair, and dark irises. His seriousness is coupled with a smile as he extrudes a long, cylindrical object from his pocket. Bringing it close to my face, he flips a switch, and for a moment, I am blinded. I tense, torn between the world I knew and what I've been granted. I relax as everything comes into focus. "So, Rachel, how do you like your new eyes?" he asks as he begins to untangle a long white cord. He sighs as he plugs it into the handheld device. My wireless scanner is down. We'll have to go analog on this one. "Difficult to get used to," I nod, and I offer him the data port behind my ear. "I told you it would be hard, but worth it. You get to experience something very few people do." There is a momentary shock as I commune with the machine beside me. "Which is?" I ask between shivers. "Rebirth. When all senses are working in concert, everything is new again." He smiles and puts a hand on my shoulder. "Embrace this and learn from your new palate." Yet there is irony here. I feel it as he unplugs the cable and turns away to analyze results. It is in my quest to fix the defect of my birth, in my journey to experience all the aspects of my humanity, that I rely on the artificial. The doubt flees as a knock on the white door is followed by a familiar voice. She came after all, and as Jane enters, all of my senses create the most beautiful of symphonies.
The story read for you by Catherine E. Baker. I'm sorry, I have to look up the title again.
By Some Illusion.
By Some Illusion.
Yes.
Thank you. By Kate Baker, Catherine E. Baker. Well, Kate on podcast.
Yes.
You didn't mention Escape Pod, I noticed.
Oh, yes, I did
which
not.
Which is actually where I first knew your name from. And when Mary Hobson was on the show a few weeks ago, she mentioned you in relation to
really?
That. Yeah.
Wow, that's very awesome.
Well, she's done some stuff with Podcastle. Mm-hmm. Or
okay, yep.
Yeah, so all related.
She's also in this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Of Sybil's Garage, and that was, in fact, your first sale.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yay.
Mary Hobson is also in the issue.
Yeah. Oh, oh, Mary's in the issue. Okay.
Mary's in the issue.
Zoom. That's right. So she is.
We actually have several first sales in this issue, I believe. If I'm not mistaken, The Telescope by Megan Kureshije was her first story. And
Sam Ferry story?
Was it?
That's right.
I think it.
Cheryl's?
No. It was. That's right. Cheryl Barkowskis. It was her first story. I don't think it was Sam's.
What about Tom's?
No, Tom's been published.
Okay. He's a writer of the future, right?
Oh, well, that's true.
But this actually preceded that publication.
Okay, like everybody is off mic at this point.
He's been in Beneath Ceaseless Skies.
Yeah. Kate, why don't you return one of the mics
over
to
that? Why? I like
to that. Yeah, I know. I'm not sure which of the two are one is working, one is very tiny. It's yours that's working. So
Kate,
Eugene,
you were saying during the song that some markets
said just what I said before, that they love the story, but it's not speculative enough for
right,
them.
Right, right. Yeah, I got about maybe 6 or 7 rejections saying that, you know, wow, this was a very moving story, and they each had slightly different reasons as to why they weren't accepting it, but I didn't know what I was going to do with it because I just kept getting discouraged, and then I saw some sort of tweet that Sybil's Garage was the last day to submit, and I went, oh, yay, I could possibly do this. And I waited and waited for the rejection, and then when it came, the acceptance came in, I was like, did I just read that right? No, I didn't read that right. No, what? No,
I think you sent back to me, like, I had to reread your email about seven, ten times, twenty times.
And I don't know, you can't see this at home, but my book is very loved because I sleep with it.
Okay, I'm sure I'm thinking of that Ray Bradbury video again.
Yeah.
But
I keep it right next to the pillow and I caress it. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, but we were all talking for a while. Barbara was mentioning about rejections, in which we were talking about acceptances in Slush earlier. I don't think we've ever really done a proper show about rejections.
Yeah, because part of what I was saying was that, you know, after you first start sending things in, you have different types of rejections. There is the, hello, anonymous person. thank you very much. Don't call us, we'll call you. And then there are the anonymous person ones that are more positive, saying, please send again. And then there are the incredibly frustrating ones that say, gee, you're such a good writer, and that was so nice, and I really enjoyed writing it, but it just wasn't right for us.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or the even more frustrating thing of, well, we just bought one just like it, so we really can't use this one. Better luck next time. And I've had ones that say, why don't you send it to this other magazine? And, of course, I just got a rejection from that other magazine.
Yeah, just like that at Gimbel's, yeah.
The most frustrating one I got was once when the main editor heard me read a story which hadn't been published and said, oh, you have to send it in to us. And I did, and thought, oh, well, this is a sale. I can have the party right now. And then 2 weeks later, I got the rejection from one of her other editors saying, yeah, I'm really sorry, but we bought one on this topic about 2 weeks ago, and I've never been able to actually get into that.
Well, I mean, I guess that's important. That it sounds to me like the editors weren't communicating. We try in Sybil's Garage to always say something about the story that's positive, even with limited exception. We usually say something about the story. You know, we like this element, but this part didn't work. We like this element, this part didn't work. And because of that, because we give longer responses than other markets, we were ranked fairly high in Duotrope magazine as one of the most personable markets. I don't know.
Not just longer responses, but also faster responses.
We averaged, I think,
that's an important thing.
20 days for response time, which is pretty good. Now, I have to say this: we don't receive nearly as many submissions as like Clark's World, for example. And I understand that when you're a magazine with a popularity as Clark's World or some of these other larger magazines, when you're getting thousands of submissions, that you can't always be personal. But because we get, I think we received about 550 stories for this issue, and split among 7 people, so it averaged between, you know, probably about what? Someone do the math. I can't do it.
70
stories, yeah, whatever, or something like that. You could take the time to write out a couple sentences.
Can I, Matt, because yeah. I've never actually talked to Slush people like this before.
Slush people. I like that. I was a
when you get
reader.
A story, you know, can you, like, read the first couple of sentences and say, okay, you know, put it aside? Or do you consciously read at least into, like, half the story or the entire story?
Personally, and I'll let the other editors speak as well, but I'll read to a point when I just know that this is not a story I'm, you know, and I figure, I know pretty quickly I'm not going to buy this story. So if I get to the point, at that point, I say, okay, you know, I stop reading. Sometimes stories have an interesting enough premise where I want to read all the way through, even though I'm not quite sure it's working. So it really just depends on the story. But yeah, there are times when I will read a couple paragraphs and go, okay, this isn't working. I don't know if others do that.
I had a rule, we had a rule when I was a first reader at, Lord help me, Galaxy magazine going way back. And three words that were usually a clue to a rejection were, aye, aye, sir.
I agree. You can tell if the story is going to work for you or not real quickly after, like, within a few lines on the, or getting a little bit into the first page. But because at Sybil's we try to at least include some sort of constructive guidance in our rejection, that's been obliging me to read further than I ordinarily would be inclined to. So I finished nearly all the stories that came into my submission queue just so I could have something constructive and helpful to say about them. Without that rule, I probably wouldn't have bothered.
Yeah, I do that too. I find that it has to be a real stinker before I won't finish it. But you know, I think it also has to do with the fact that I really love stories that kind of keep you hanging, and then, like, at the end there's this big reveal. So even if I don't like a story, I'm hoping for them to pull it out in the last paragraph or two. And so
you ever skip ahead?
They never do, though.
Sometimes
they never do. You always know in that first page. But nonetheless, like Paul said, I do read the stories all the way through so that I can try to give some sort of feedback to the writer. But you can always tell. It's amazing. That first page is really, really tells you the whole story.
What are the submission guidelines?
Well, they're on the website, but in terms of
not everybody listening has access to the web. So.
Well, it's right now we're not open to submissions, but when we are open, it's short stories up to 5,000 words, poems up to 50 lines, and we take all speculative fiction and so-called literary or mainstream fiction as well. We will look at science fiction, fantasy, horror, also stuff that crosses boundaries. It's not easily classifiable. What else is there?
It has a certain literary quality, would you say?
Yes, but I think that term is incredibly subjective. So I tell people, if in doubt, send it to us.
Mm-hmm. I think historically we were looking for things that had very rich tones and a strong sense of atmosphere, but also just something about the story that just made us stop and say, wow, and that could be anything. I think in this issue number 7, there's a lot more of the content is clearly one genre or another, clearly science fiction, clearly fantasy, or clearly slipstream, which I don't really think was the case in the past. I think we were looking for a little bit more of everything in the past.
We made a concerted effort this issue to publish more traditional stories. Sorry, someone's handing me the submissions guideline from the web. We made a concerted effort to publish more traditional stories this issue because in some ways I felt we were getting typecasted as, oh, that slipstream market or that interstitial market. I have, no problem with people thinking that, oh, I have a slipstream story, I want to send it to Sybil's Garage, that's fine. But I didn't want people to say that that's all we do. So this issue, we definitely made an effort to publish more broadly.
Mm-hmm. I think it's worth pointing out that you also encourage diversity in the fiction.
That's a good point. I had a lot of discussions with K. Tempest Bradford on how I could increase both the diversity of characters in stories and cultures, as well as the diversity of authors. Because of that, I don't know because of that, but I think so, that we actually, in this issue, I think we have authors from 7 different countries and from a lot of different cultures, and in the past issues as well. And we want, I think sometimes as editors, we just assume, okay, we just put the call for submissions and therefore that's enough. And I don't think that's enough. I think sometimes you have to reach out to places that may not necessarily be aware that your market is open to publishing things like that. And I think as doing something, putting that in the guidelines, like we have explicitly on the website, we say, we are very interested in seeing stories written by and or including varied ethnicities, social classes, and nationalities. We'd like to see more stories featuring underutilized cultures and settings. Our editors and readers represent a variety of backgrounds, and we're always working to ensure that our publication reflects that as well. So the guidelines said it better than I could.
Okay, very good.
I think it helps that most of there's a pretty wide spectrum of interests and cultures in the editors.
Yeah, the
as
editors.
Well.
Yeah, we have African American editors. Jewish, Asian, Latino, Indian American. So I think we represent a broad spectrum ourselves. And I think that helps with the slush. I mean, like the stories that we like to print and read. And I'm also, I'm always careful to, if I get a story that's not quite working, but it's from another culture, I always sort of say, I wonder, is this my Western bias? Looking at this story and saying, oh, it doesn't fit my Western point of view as to what a story should be, but maybe I'm not. Maybe I'm biased, and so I think that's something that as editors we have to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it must be a difficult tightrope act, because on the one hand you try to free yourself from cultural bias, and yet you have to maintain a certain editorial stance in order to make the magazine, the journal, what it is.
Right. I mean, I think I'd like to surprise people. I also like to challenge people. I think that there are definitely stories in this issue in particular that are challenging, that may not appeal to everybody. In the last issue, we had a story by James B. Pepe, I Am Enkidu's Wild Brother, and there was a lot of mixed opinions about that story among strongly mixed opinions. But it was actually shortlisted for the Best American Fantasy recently, that story. So we took a risk with that, and we take a risk with certain stories, and not all the stories are that way, but I think that we can do that as a small press. I don't know if some of the bigger markets would be able to get away with that. And maybe they can, I don't know, but I think they can.
You know, my favorite part of the whole process is, what Matt will do is he'll put a hold on stories that he thinks are strong contenders. So we had over 550 submissions. So he put a hold on about 40 stories, maybe 40 to 50 stories. And my favorite part of the process is when we get down to those finalists and we really debate. Some of us have our particular favorites and we're really pushing for our favorites. And there's a great exchange among the editors about which stories they want and which stories they don't want. And that's definitely the best part for me of the
essentially
process.
Essentially each story gets its own little blog, and we all put our comments, and we can go back and read what everyone wrote. And it's always kind of heartbreaking for me, because I write as well, and for those last few stories, some of them that I have to reject that we've held on to for three or 4 months or 5 months or sometimes 6 months, And it's just like, you know, it's so close, but it's just, you know, and you understand being a writer what they're feeling, so it's like you have to.
Every one of your editors is a writer, is that correct?
That is correct, yeah.
Yeah, and that's not always the case with a lot of journals and magazines, that the editors are not always necessarily the writers as well, are not writers as well. Not everybody comes from that discipline. You work in the KGB Fantastic Fiction series with Ellen Datlow, who has never written fiction.
There are
any number of editors who have never done that.
John Joseph Adams, I know at one point, I think he wrote a screenplay about it. He doesn't write anymore, mm-hmm. but he's an amazing editor and all these stuff that he puts out. You know?
It's a very specific discipline.
If you do it full time, I think that you can't really do anything else. That's why Sybil's Garage is a part-time thing for us. But when we do work on it, we all, you know, putting our heart and soul into it.
Yeah. Well, astonishingly, we have like 4 minutes left before I have to start the outro music here. And by the way, Watson, as I please this morning.
It's going to be music, music, music.
Ooh, more Mahler. we need more Mahler. And here's the Mahler. Anyway, I think that what I would like to do at this point is once again go around the room, tell people that what we are gathered for this morning is we're discussing the journal, multiple issues of Sybil's Garage, issue 7 of which came out about a month ago, 5 weeks ago.
Yeah,
is that about right?
July 21st, I think.
And will remain in print because it's available on demand.
That's right.
So let's hold off, but warn everybody right now, get your pencils and paper or whatever it is so that you can jot down. We're going to tell you how to get a copy and how to submit to the magazine, that is.
Okay.
Not getting into any of that other stuff. let's also, once again, just have everybody, I guess, counterclockwise go around the room and say who you are and what your relationship to all this is.
Sure. I'm David Mercurio Rivera, and I've been an editor of Sybil's Garage since issue 2 or 3. Great experience reading The Slush. I'm a science fiction writer whose stories have appeared in Electric Velocipede, Nature, regularly in Interzone, Black Static, and elsewhere. And Sybil's Garage is amazing, and I urge you to give it a shot.
And I'm Barbara Krasnoff, and I'm a short story writer who was incredibly pleased to be in 2 issues of Sybil's Garage, number 4 and 5. And you can see my blog and see lists of every place I've been published on my website at BrooklynWriter.com.
I'm Kate Baker, and I am also very pleased to be in Sybil's Garage, my first published story. And you can also find me podcasting for Clark's World magazine. I'm also managing John Scalzi's site, The Whatever, while he's on vacation. And I think that's it. So I'll pass it over to Eugene.
Hi, I'm Eugene Myers. I publish as E.C. Myers. I have a story in Sybil's Garage number 7. I also have read Slush for the magazine in the past. I have a story upcoming in Shimmer magazine, which is another great small press. I'm not sure which issue, but it might be number 12. Anyway, coming soon. You can check out my website and my blog, which are kind of under construction right now, or reconstruction, at ecmyers.net. That's ecmyers.net. And I pass it to you, Devin.
My name's Devin Poore, and I've been with Sybil since pretty much the beginning, associate editor and also contributing nonfiction interviews and articles. And I'm also a short story writer, novelist, and website's devinjpoore.com.
I'm Paul Berger. I'm a science fiction and fantasy writer and also an associate editor at Sybil's Garage. Which means I read Slush and occasionally work with authors to tweak or rewrite bits of the story. And in fact, I remember working with Barbara on one of her first stories for Sybil's. You can find me at paulmberger.com.
And I'm Matthew Kressel, and I am the publisher and editor of Sybil's Garage. You can find Sybil's Garage at census5.com. That's SENSESFIVE.com. It's also available on Amazon.com. And I'm also a writer, which I didn't talk about, and my webpage is matthewkressel.net, K-R-E-S-S-E-L.net. And I just wanted to thank Jim for having us today, and just wanted to thank everyone here, the editors, for doing an amazing job helping me out and just really supporting the whole Sybil's Garage enterprise and the authors for reading their amazing stories. I hope you guys will submit to us again.
When is the next submission period likely to start?
It will likely start around January, and we usually are open for about 4 months. And you can find the guidelines on the website, census5.com, as well.
And I am Jim Freund, producer and host, pardon, of Hour of the Wolf, which is now at an end. But I would like to thank everybody for being here. I will also, second and third, I'll eighth the recommendation for Sybil's Garage. Next week on this program, I'm Brenda Clough. And, well, lots of exciting stuff to come up. Tune in again. Check out the website for more details at ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F. Woefully out of date, but not completely. Anyhow, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for As I Please with Simon Locally, and have a lovely day. Oh, yeah, it might snow, so wear those galoshes. Take care, and good morning.